This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 20th of October 2014 on Monocle 24. Culture is brought to you in association with Persol. Hello and welcome to the 158th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bounds. This week, things look like this. We'll get a roundup of who bought what at this year's MIPCOM, the International TV Format Marketplace in Cannes.
It's all about the big budget, the really sort of high-end drama stuff that was getting people going, whether that's from the States or the UK or whether that's from, you know, other places in the world.
We'll speak to a playwright from Hong Kong about her experience of the protests and how we might have seen trouble ahead as we mark her play Filth opening in London.
In a sense, it's a universal story about a breakdown of marriage. I mean, if you read really into it, it's kind of like a metaphor for Hong Kong in a sense, right? You know, it's like, does Hong Kong stay or do they go? And it kind of ties in again, you know, with democracy or leave it how it is.
Plus, we'll welcome Hot Chip Side Project's new build for a live Midori House session, hear about every art collector's favourite new app, and hear how opera's once again attempting to open its arms to the ordinary. That's all to come here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. For the past few weeks, we've been fairly mellow with our sessions. Plenty of soulful voices and plenty of delicate guitars. Well, as lovely as that's been, this week we're plugging in and cranking up the volume. New Build are a London-based electronic outfit consisting of members pinched from Hot Chip and LCD Sound Systems lineup. Their self-released debut album, Yesterday Was Lived and Lost, failed to receive as much attention as they'd have liked, but now they're back with a brand new offering that's sure to get people's ears switched on and their toes are tapping. Pour It On is the new record. A new build came by recently to play us a few tracks from it. First up, here they are with White Sea.
I've given up so much, I don't know if I can relinquish anymore. Not giving up, just making sure this is the life I sign myself up for. To the White Sea, she's taking me to the Red Sea. She's taking me to the sea. To the Black Sea, she's taking me to the Red Sea. She's taking me to the sea. We'll be right back.
That was New Build playing their track White Sea, and here's a fact, that's the first time they've ever played that live. Every year, while our eyes are trained on the booths of the Frieze Art Fair and others are trained on the silver screens of the London Film Festival, the big players of the small screen are gathered in Cannes for the annual marketplace for TV formats. The Aussies buying British game shows, the Koreans adapting Dutch reality TV, the Americans importing the latest Scandinavian hot property. The Croisette in Cannes throngs with execs, wannabes and salesmen with suitcases full of TV gold. And who's the man to sift through it all? Well, it's Peter White of Broadcast Magazine.
12 months ago, this time, everyone was looking at finding the new hot entertainment format. And I know you and I have talked about it a lot. Rising Star, the Israeli series was the one that everyone was really sort of hot on. But this year at MIP in Cannes, it was pretty much mainly about drama. Those were the big shows. There was a few sort of non-scripted entertainment shows at Corby's Eye. But yeah, it was all about the big budget, the really sort of high-end drama stuff that was getting people going, whether that's from the States or the UK or whether that's from, you know, other places in the world.
Are these formats that have been sort of tried and tested in one territory, maybe, and they're then being sold? Or are these sort of brand new written formats that are being presented to people? Do people buy drama shows on the strength of a script, or do they buy them mainly on the strength of their performance within one country?
A bit of both. It can work both ways. Probably the perfect example was Grace Point, which is the American version of Broadchurch. You and I both know that Broadchurch was a massive hit here last year for ITV, and Fox actually bought the US rights on the basis of a script. The producers went out there to show them that, and they loved it, and they decided they wanted to do their own version. So yeah, it happens both ways. And obviously then, having seen the success in the UK, they lapped it up for the American version, which sort of strangely still stars David Tennant in a different character but same character kind of way. He plays a cop, but a different cop than he plays in Broadchurch.
Is he a Scottish cop that's been relocated, or is he an American cop?
He's an American cop. Okay. With an American accent.
If you or someone you know has noticed anything unusual, please tell the police immediately. There will be no hiding place for Danny's killer. We will catch whoever did this.
And David Duchovny has made a Charles Manson drama called Aquarius.
Yeah.
Is he starring in that, or is he just the producer?
No, he's fronting it. He's got a very short haircut, and he's playing again the sort of in another cop show. Aquarius is this kind of sort of quite dark cop drama where he plays this policeman who's searching for a killer, and it turns out to be Charles Manson. So the story goes that he's trying to sort of find out Charles Manson's gang, and he's sort of on the hunt of all of his cronies, and I don't know, I haven't seen the last episode as to whether he catches him or not, but I have a feeling they're going to want that to run, so he might not catch him in the first series. But Duchovny was in...
Do not expect satisfaction at the
exactly,
end. Yeah.
I'm not sure there's going to be a payoff, but he was in Cannes to promote it. I mean, just to give you an example of how important that these stars and these, you know, American channels and British channels think of these things is they get the A-list talent down there to sort of, you know, flog the shows for them. So yeah, they really see some value in that. But yeah, it's not just, you know, as you say, you know, people will buy that whether they think that's a good show, they'll see it. But there's a lot of things where they're more curious about the idea. Can they remake it? Can they sort of redo it? You know, some examples, the Scandi drama, people are always keeping their eye on, is there stuff that they can remake, and the same for Turkey is another place that people are looking more for scripts, because I can't really see Turkish drama being on air in English language countries or anywhere really other than local market.
And I think we were sort of joking that Turkey is apparently the new Israel. At Cannes every year, we always want someone being the new somewhere else. I think France was the new Scandinavia last time. I don't know if that was in terms of dramas or formats.
Yeah. And then I think Ireland was the new France, or yeah, there was. We've had a few. It does, and that's the story. Everyone likes that sort of idea as to where is the new hot market. You know, we joke, but actually, these people are running around, you know, looking at sort of Turkish distributors' catalogues and seeing if there's anything in there that they can take and buy.
So we've said, Peter, that it was a strong a strong MIPCOM for drama. We can't let you hang up your telephone without talking us through the entertainment formats. A lot of dating shows that you flagged up for us. And it seems like the... Well, let's not say the words lowest common denominator, but they're certainly not going overboard with the clothing budget for these shows, are they?
No, apparently naked is the hot new format. Whether they can throw that into dating or sort of competition shows, but yeah, and everyone's been trying to crack the dating thing for a few years. We haven't had a show that's really taken off in there since Take Me Out, I guess, was probably the last one. VH1 has got Dating Naked in the States, where basically they put a man and a woman together and see if they like each other, except they're not wearing anything. So I guess you sort of get everything up front.
Everything is right there in front of this guy that I don't know. Woohoo! I get to go out with Joe. See the package.
I definitely saw Wee Wee checking me out.
And the other one in that vein is there's Love Prison, which is similarly maybe a few more clothes, but a bit more of a, you know, locking these people together to see if they like each other.
Love Prison does sound like sounds like a Spinal Tap B-side to Sex Farm. It does sound
exactly
pretty disturbing.
Smell the Glove, isn't it? It could be the track off there. But yeah, I mean, they come up with it, sort of, any sort of crazy take on this, and obviously, you know, Ireland's are hot. You know, Bear Grylls was on his, and you know they like that idea of taking people out of their comfort zones. You always get some interesting things. But no, there were some other bonkers entertainment shows, and some of my favourites. You've got the Dutch format, Celebrity Pole Dancing, which pretty much it says what it does on the tin. There's a Turkish and Israeli show, a sort of co-production, which is essentially a tug of war. It's nothing more, nothing less. You've got All-Star Lifeguards, which is a sort of Finnish version of a reality version of Baywatch.
Ei tosiaankaan saatu sitä siitä ylös. Siis se tuntui siltä, kun sä olisit oikeasti yrittänyt taloa nostaa.
Kello käy, kello käy! Nyt nopee! Vielä vaan mennään!
Maybe we'll save our best for last. This is Man versus Fly. It's a British format. When I say talk us through it, Peter, I think this is probably a one-liner.
A little bit. It is pretty much, again, Man versus Fly in a small room, and it's got a sort of piss-taking voiceover to it, a little bit Come Dine With Me style. But it was originally made for The Sun, which isn't really where you tend to watch a lot of these types of shows. But now they're sort of been out in Cannes, and they're talking about turning it into a full half-hour show where you sort of hear the backstory of the fly, and then you sort of see these guys to see if they can swat it. Yeah, TV's getting even simpler as it sounds, right?
One man. I've been gearing myself up. I'm not quite sure what I'm going to do, but yeah, probably a bit of a wicked kiss. Come well prepared.
One fly.
My weapon is fantastic. I'm going to keep it for public transport. Stand back, smelly, arm-pitted individuals.
1 minute to kill it.
I don't do flies. I mean, I draw the line somewhere, darling. You know, I mean, really. It's not true what they say about the homosexuals.
Man versus Fly.
That was Broadcast Magazine's Peter White. After the break, I'll be speaking to playwright Jing-Anne McPherson-Young about her latest production, Filth.
There's a new sound coming to Monocle 24.
This is Nick Luskin. Join me for new music from around the world, Wednesday, 1500 London time. We'll be bringing live sessions and interviews to the mix every week, and all kinds of wonderful artists and records that you might not know yet, but you're sure to love.
That's brand new music from around the world. Monocle presents Nick Luskin every Wednesday, 1500 hours London time.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Now, the pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong have brought fresh focus to an island which is normally regarded as a calm haven from bridled commerce on the edge of the world's largest communist country, but no longer. And as our next guest says, we could have seen it coming. Jing-Anne McPherson-Young is a young playwright with a list of stages filled with her work already, but one sticks out. Filth, it stands for Failed in London, Try Hong Kong, and it's a story of expats falling in and out of love with each other and the place they've wound up. Jing-Anne swung by Midori House ahead of her show at London's Soho Theatre.
It was the first play that was commissioned and produced by the Hong Kong Arts Festival in English.
Yeah.
It was a kind of 2 year in the making process. They asked me to, you know, write a play about something that was much more kind of close to home. And in terms of the reception, I'd say because it is a play about, I mean, I'm not going to say it's putting the kind of middle bourgeois you know, expats on trial. It's not entirely that, but it is a kind of way to, you know, reflect the mirror on a society that essentially is within that weird kind of ethnological Disneyland that is Hong Kong. And also about the local people. So in terms of, well, I suppose, so the mainstream audience would be essentially people who go to the Hong Kong Arts Festival, which are patrons, and this exact, the exact characters in this play. And I'd say it was a mixed, I'd say actually the local Hong Kong audience found it extremely funny and kind of, I don't know, surrendered themselves to this kind of black comedy. Essentially, that's what it is. It is kind of a satire, but it's also a human, you know, love story. It's a, you know, universal story. But in terms of, I'd say it was pretty mixed with the expats, but I'd say they weren't too happy with the way that they were portrayed.
Well, let's talk about it. It's FILTH, as we said at the beginning, it's a great acronym. It stands for Fell in London, Try Hong Kong.
Yes.
By the way, is this a well-known phrase in Hong Kong? Do people know what this means?
It is a well-known phrase. Yeah. I'm so surprised that a lot of people in the UK don't know this acronym. They think it's the Irvine Welsh novel, and you're like, oh, it's this long, you know, kind of thing that they have fixed themselves like badges of honour, you know. They're actually quite proud of it in a sense, even though it's really derogatory. It's like the Guailo.
Right.
You know, which is the kind of eponymous phrase that we use in Hong Kong to describe the expats.
The white expats, I suppose.
The white expats, yeah.
And tell us a little bit about the protagonists in the play, what people can expect when they trot dutifully down to Dean Street to watch the play.
Well, hopefully they'll see people that they do recognise.
Yeah.
But a lot of it, for me, is it's setting a really universal story about a breakdown of a marriage. That's essentially what it is. It's a breakdown of a marriage set against this kind of really changing Hong Kong right off. It's 10 years after the handover. It's set during, you know, the kind of July 1st celebrations. And the main protagonists have to make a choice. Do they stay or do they leave? And the married couple, Joe Losey and Rebecca Losey, you know, it's a marriage that probably shouldn't have happened. But in a sense, it was for love and it was for convenience, you know, because she's this kind of high-flying editor and he's kind of a loaf. And he, you know, they met at uni and they fell in love. And she said, hey, you know, come back to Hong Kong and you can have all these things which you could never have dreamed of, which, you know, a lot of expats are lucky enough to have that kind of privilege, you know, chauffeur, you know, maid, amazing kind of accoutrements, you know, whatever. And yeah, so in a sense, it's a universal story about a breakdown of marriage, but a kind of a, I mean, if you read really into it, it's kind of like a metaphor for Hong Kong in a sense, right? You know, it's like, does Hong Kong stay or do they go? And it kind of ties in again, you know, with democracy or leave it how it is.
Exactly. What kind of a marriage was it? I like that. You know, was it like the Brits versus the Chinese? It felt like that. Was there an exiting power? I suppose this is the nice parallel that you draw in the play is the marriage. It was a marriage on all levels, wasn't it? Presumably, I guess. And that's the deal. And what about in London? Do people, because we could be very snobbish. I think a friend of yours reviewed one of the best books of this year, Joseph O'Neill's The Dog, which is about expats in Dubai.
Lawrence Osborne
reviewed it in the New York Times, I think, and sort of said that we're horribly snobbish about expats when we all have the potential to be one, and we're all kind of ploughing our own furrow somehow. Do you have a bit of a love-hate relationship? I mean, how does it work for you? Is this something that was born out of kind of pure filthy rage about a certain sector of Hong Kong society, or does it go into the kind of subtlety of trying to make ends meet and being attracted by low taxes and the maid and all the accoutrements you talked about? I mean, presumably it's a little bit more than a rage-filled play, isn't it?
Right. I mean, I didn't have my way. I had all these people telling me I've got to make it a no. No, you have to like these characters, and you do like them because they are these people who kind of exile themselves. And they do, you know, when you move to another country, why do you move to another country halfway across the world? You know, it's really not just for the job, is it? And it's this ability to sympathize with someone who, you know, wants to change. But as human nature dictates, we just don't like changing. We really don't like change. And in a sense, you know, it wasn't a complete rage fest. You know, there are moments where it's, you know, kind of really critiquing the way that they kind of hold themselves up and they create this fear of, you know, nepotism and all that. But that's with every society, has those little bubbles, little pockets. I think what was interesting is that because I went to an international school, but I was kind of an outsider my whole life, and being mixed race and kind of looking at from two sides and being in this melting pot, but not quite fitting in. And then again, it's this identity crisis. So it comes all back to that. And looking at it, I felt as a kind of, yeah, as an outsider, I could kind of look at things not objectively, but in an interesting way, to really kind of put them on a plane where they've never been seen before, where I think expats haven't been seen before, except maybe in, you know, kind of the novels of, you know, Ian Forster. And, you know, we haven't really seen that on stage. You know, it's not about making a big kind of diatribe, political diatribe about, oh, you know, we all hate expats. Look at them. They're horrible. Look at what they do. You know, they've got so much money. It's more about trying to search for a way to understand them, really.
There's an element to it, which seems like it's a comedy of is a very unfashionable thing to talk about in terms of the theatre, but a comedy of manners as much as it is a comedy of politics and a romance or lack of one as well, right? I mean, it's one of those things. And before we go, it'd be nice to talk about Hong Kong itself. What's it like working in Hong Kong? I knew you were commissioned to write Filth, but what's the theatre scene like? Is it something that needs a bit of a kick up the bum? Is it something that needs, or is it something that people need to be attracted to? Is it something that is sort of sponsored and propagated, or is it something where you feel like you're, you know, you're kind of a bit of a lone wolf kind of writing stuff and hoping that it gets somewhere sometimes?
I mean, yeah. I mean, it needs a good kick up the, you know, it really does. A lot of it is, you know, there is a willing audience, but it's trying to get them out of their bedrooms on their laptops and trying to really put them into a situation which they're not used to, which is a live room with a live audience where something's happening and you have to make a connection with a living person. Yeah. And that's a real comment on, you know, Hong Kong society, you know, how it's driven really just by money in many senses.
That was Jing-An McPherson-Young, and look out for her name on a billboard near you soon. Coming up in the next half hour of the show, more energetic electronica from New Build. We'll head back to Frieze London to meet the man behind a clever way of staying on top of your art collection. Plus, we'll go to Toronto for a performance that marries French electro with the opera. That's all here to come on Culture with me, Robert Pound, on Monocle 24. Onwards to the dance floor. New Build are playing tracks from their new record Pour It On for us this week, with synths aplenty and even a steel drum in the mix somewhere. Here they are with Look In Vain.
Thank you.
Sometimes how you cannot see that it's all in the way that you measure me. I can't survive and I can't sustain. Look in vain for the traces.
Thanks.
I'm joined by Al and Felix from New Build, also sometime of Hot Chip. But you guys have got your own new record out at the moment, and you just came and kind of sonically assaulted us in the performance space just now, which I don't think anyone was expecting. But
I feel we weren't expecting it.
Yeah, we all went on a bit of a journey because some of those songs you haven't even performed live. Tell people about the new record and what that's all about.
It's called Pour It On. It's our second album. We're really proud of the record. It's been a long time coming. It's always hard to kind of shoehorn these things into the Hot Chip schedule and what used to be the LCD schedule, and I was still doing that. And it's really nice to actually get it out there and get people sort of listening to the music. So we're really, really happy about it.
People might not strictly hear it on first impressions, but I was reading up a bit and apparently you're kind of influenced a little bit by kind of English folk, and some of that kind of world has sort of rubbed off on the record. How are you sort of interpreting that into sort of quite loud?
It's definitely, it's not at the forefront of what the sound is about, but it's definitely got, you know, some vague influence from that, I guess. I mean, some of the melodies, I guess, may sound a little bit sort of pentatonic, a little bit sort of folksy, but it's certainly not down on the farm kind of music. It's pretty unashamedly electronic all the way through. The new record is got far less kind of guitar-y rock kind of influences on it, and it's pretty, even the songs that are not so overtly dancey, we wanted them to have that kind of very heavy sonic quality that would stand up to kind of modern dance productions and that kind of thing. But you know, at the same time, there's a couple of songs, I guess, that both Felix and I used to listen to a lot of, like Richard and Linda Thompson and Incredible String Band and things like that, but it's quite an oblique influence.
We've just got a different definition of, like, what a kind of pastoral version of Englishness could be, maybe. I don't know, it's quite, I guess it's different, but it seems valid in my head, at least, that it's more than just, like, an acoustic guitar and a banjo or something.
Yeah.
Obviously I love Incredible String Band, which is like mostly really simple arrangements and, you know, instrumentation, but some of the ideas in it are really like quite strange and
experimental,
eccentric and different, and I guess that's what we maybe tap into a bit.
And it's sort of addressing some issues that maybe would fall into that category. There's sort of some slight political elements to some of the music.
I wanted to ask about that because you come across as guys who maybe don't want to be shoving agendas down people's throats.
Yeah.
But also, I mean, there are things going on in the world and you live in the world and you're obviously trying to reference that in some way. Where do you sort of draw the line on a song where you're like, oh no, we've turned into the Clash? Or something?
Yeah, exactly. I think you're right. I get very turned off personally by sort of heart on your sleeve kind of political music. Is not something that I ever listened to or have been that interested in the past. But
you don't love Frank Turner.
there's a couple of like kind of songs that, you know, for instance, the one that I always talk about, it's a very famous song, but Shipbuilding by Elvis Costello, that was recorded by Robert Wyatt, which is obviously a very political song, but it doesn't really, you know, unless you sort of knew what the background to that song was, it wouldn't necessarily be something that you would kind of get from listening to it. And that's the kind of angle that we were going for, or even probably one step removed from that, even again, just a general sense of misery and unease and anger sort of seeping through, and just a sense of, like, you know, unfairness perhaps.
I think Robert Wyatt's quite a good reference because he actually does have songs that are very kind of overtly political that I just really like because they're very good music and his voice is really amazing. So I think that just shows that you can have a song that's about, like, Steve Biko or, you know, raising the red flag or whatever it is. It's not like it doesn't matter that that's what it's about, but it's kind of like,
but it stands on its own.
Yeah, you still listen to it as
the,
like,
political content.
You listen to it as brilliant music as well as having this kind of protest. Yeah. Not that I'm saying that we're...
It was a really weird thing to kind of have to talk about as well, because we knew it was going to sort of come up once the record came out. But of course, you know, it's such an unfashionable thing. It's just something that never really crops up like at all in most sort of kind of popular music these days. And you wouldn't have to go back very far for it to be a thing. Like, you know, it's just sort of weird to me that sort of people aren't kind of card-carrying kind of red socially. Like, as kids, that just used to be what people were in the 80s.
We're just a bit of a beaten-down kind of society in general, so I think music reflects that.
That was Felix Martin and Al Doyle from New Build, and the new record, Pour It On, is out now on Sunday Best Records. Head to newbuildband.com if you want to learn a little more. This is Culture on Monocle 24, and I am Robert Bound. Frankly, we're still a little overwhelmed by all the fun of the Frieze Art Fair, where sales were strong. So what happens when you've got such a sprawling art collection that it's tricky keeping tabs on your Cy Twombly's? When it's a job to remember where you've put your last Robert Rauschenberg? Well, you might need Art Engine, a new app that might just be described as a virtual gallery of all the works you own, presented in high def. Jan Winkelmann was in town from Germany to tell us how it works and who needs it.
Art Engine is a cloud-based software solution for collectors. We launched in end of March. It's a so-called web app. That means it runs in every internet browser, wherever you kind of access it from, be it your tablet, your mobile phone, or your desktop at home, your notebook, wherever.
This is pictures, paintings, sculptures, all the things that you own. You've got in a database, and you've got exactly. High-res images. You can zoom in, you can zoom out, you can catalogue them all on the app that you've invented.
Exactly, yeah.
This is an app for maybe the sort of highest net worth individuals in the world. It's a very specific idea. Is this something that you needed yourself, or is this something you noticed that maybe galleries have to look at what they've got? How do you try and bring something which is very specialist and move that out into sort of the general sphere?
Well, we are kind of operating, the art world is still a niche, even if you kind of walk around here and see so many people and see what it generates, the buzz it generates, it's still a niche. So we have to be clear about that. But the starting point was actually an artist friend of mine approached me like 2 years ago and said, listen, you're a specialist in the kind of field software, internet, and the arts. Can you recommend me a software where I can kind of keep track of all my artworks? I have 4 galleries. I consign works to each gallery. They are sold. I lend so many works to exhibitions, etc. I want to, at the moment, I'm kind of writing it down in a book, and I want to kind of have it in a smart...
They're not the kind of things you want to lose, are they?
Exactly.
Expensive artworks. They can go walkies, can't they?
Yeah. and it's kind of, yeah, for each work, you have so many informations, like be it the artist name, the title, the measurements, the dimensions, materials, the value, sales price, etc., etc. And I recommended him some software that is already existing on the market, and he looked into it and said, listen, this is much too complicated, much too complex. Wouldn't it be a niche to do something much more intuitive, much more easy to use, maybe cloud-based, to kind of solve our problems? So I thought, well, this could actually be a nice idea. And we talked to our developers and asked them, and they said, no, yes, no problem, we can do that. And then we kind of spent a year developing it, went into beta by autumn last year, and officially launched in March.
So that the baby's been conceived and now it's been born.
Exactly.
Are there specific elements of it, maybe not on the technical side, but on the way that it works, the way that you can look at imagery of these artworks? Is there something that makes it specifically handy for an art collector? Are there specific ways of making it work that kind of make images pop off the screen? There is a statistic, I think, someone at an art fair in South America told me that, you know, 70% of the work they sell off a JPEG, which is an amazing thing. I guess this is the market that you're tapping into, or if not the market, the usability of these images.
Exactly. We kind of put lots of attention to the usability in front of the background that many of our, let's say, the competitors, they are, as I mentioned before, much too complicated. We put a specific eye on kind of a usability. So you can upload high-res images, as you mentioned before. But during the process of uploading it, they were going kind of down calculated so that you have four different sizes. That means if you look at them on the iPad, you see them full screen in the brightest and best resolution that's possible for a Retina display, for instance. You have it always with you. That's the advantage of being a web app. That means you don't need to synchronize whatever. So if somebody, if you upload a work and go to the fair, you just have it with you, which means you always have your collection with you, no matter where you go.
And this is presumably great for people at events like this who maybe want to sell something, consign something to a gallery or an auction house, as much as people that just want to check through their stock, as it were,
sure.
Right? I mean, there's another element to this. Let me ask you, just before we finish, Jan, about the privacy of something like this, because, of course, a lot of collectors want to know what other people have. A lot of journalists want to know what collectors have. How do you sort of safeguard who has what and who looks at what?
Our engine is just, it's below the surface. That means you can, only users have access to it. There is a function that you can upload some works or assign some works to the showroom, and that you can share with some other colleagues, friends, collectors' friends, etc. But besides that, we have this SSL certificate. That means it's the common standard, even in the banking sector. So
yeah.
I say Art Engine is as safe as internet banking. So if you use internet banking, you shouldn't be afraid of privacy in terms of...
Well, that's it's good to know that. I'll put my my priceless collection of Dutch egg cups on there, and without a second's hesitation. If you could have one work on Art Engine, what would it be from this year's Frieze Art Fair?
It would be this fantastic, although I don't have the space for it, it would be this fantastic wooden piece by Carl André that is really amazing.
That was Jan Winkelmann telling us about his Art Engine at this year's Frieze. To hear more of our Frieze coverage this year, head to monocle.com/radio and seek out episodes 760 and 761 of Midori House. That happened last week. After the break, we'll be in Toronto for a performance hoping to make the opera as appealing to the city's youth as Electro. Stay tuned.
Food on film. We travel to Helsinki to meet the merchants serving up the very best in Nordic cuisine at Helsinki's oldest portside market.
Service and quality are at the very heart of the market's reinvention and its continued importance over the past 120 years. Many of the stallholders have held pitches in these pinewood stalls for generations and forged close relationships with their long-held customers.
Market value. Now playing in the film section of monocle.com.
This is Culture with me, Robert Bound. In the contemporary music scape, it's not shocking to hear different genres mix and mingle with each other. Opera, however, is one genre often left out of this equation, discounting, of course, Malcolm McLaren's Madame Butterfly. Last Thursday in Toronto, the Canadian Opera Company hosted their latest edition of Opera Nation, an annual event dedicated to making the stiff upper-lipped art form more appealing and accessible to a younger audience. This year, Opera Nation was headlined by French electro-pop group Yell. They're known in France for their subversive lyrics and frenetic beats, a stark contrast to the controlled precision of classical singing. They collaborated and put up a performance with the opera's vocalists. It was an unusual and interesting marriage of musical genres, and Monocle's Jeremy Schipper caught up with Yell's Julie Boudet to discuss the project.
We are here to play for Opera Nation, and we are really excited, you know, because it's the first time for us. You know, we are playing and singing with opera singer, and it's a great new experience for us because, you know, we are doing pop electronic music, so we are not used to this kind of voices, but actually it's really cool. We did some rehearsal and everything matches, and it gives a new way of listening to our music, and that is really cool. You know, I like experiences like that, so that's great. I'm really happy.
So when I think about Yell and your music, I think operatic is one of the last terms that I would use to describe your music. What's your personal investment or your personal interest in opera?
Actually, you know, I discovered opera really late. A few years ago, I watched an opera on TV because actually a really good friend of mine were working on the outfits. So she texted me like, you should watch it. It's on the French TV and I'm sure you're going to love it. And actually, I watched it on TV and I was totally captivated, you know, by, I don't know, the energy on stage, the voices, of course, the music. And actually, I was crying at the end of the show because it was so intense and it was so real and crazy and full of emotions. That was incredible. So I'm really interesting, you know, now I want to see an opera live. You know, each time I'm talking with people that are used to see some operas, they are, yeah, subjugated by the beauty and the intensity of, yeah, the music and the voices and everything, actually.
So tonight is about the blending not just of different genres of music, but also of music with visual arts and architecture and fashion. Who are some other artists that inspire your music? Who influences you?
You know, I was listening lots of different things. So I like pop music, of course, but I also like jazz or world music or really different thing, rock band, of course. But there is one girl that I really like for a long time because she has a whole aesthetics, you know. It's not just a singer, it's Kate Bush. You know, she's not just a singer, she's writing, she's composing, and she's building each time, you know, a real universe around a song, like, you know, in a video clip or on stage, you know, with the dance, with the outfits. It's always really deep and strong, and I really like that, you know. I like the fact that she's invested in everything and not just in the music. And for me, she's a real example because, you know, for me, it's really important, of course, to have the music first, but to propose something different, to have a real visual thing on stage, you know, to have a, for example, we have two drums, and it's really important for us to have the show like this right now because we wanted to have something really geometric, you know, on stage, like with the two drummers, and we worked on the light too. It's really important, you know, to have a global thing to propose, and I really like that.
In the visual art world, the boundary between high art and low art was dissolved many, many years ago with pop art. As a pop musician, do you believe that that same boundary still exists?
I'm not sure. I think it's probably easier today as a public, you know, to be confronted to art and to have the chance to see art, I mean, in the street, in museum, of course, but I think it's easier today to have a connection with art because art is everywhere. And of course, because of, you know, the internet generation and everything, it's easier to have the chance to be touched by art in your everyday life. It's really important for me to have the chance to propose art to people, even if they don't really want, actually. And, you know, sometimes the confrontation is the best experience, you know, when you are not waiting for something and something is happening to you. Of course, we need museum and everything, but I think we need more surprised by something at the corner of a street, and for me that's the most important.
That was Julie Boudet speaking to Monocle's Jeremy Shipper in Toronto, and that brings us to the end of the show. Next week there's a few tricks and plenty of treats as we get prepared for Halloween. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where my producer was Holly Fisher. And I'd like to thank her and mark her out personally for putting up my appalling vocal performance on this week's show. Time for one final song this week from New Build. This is The Sunlight. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you.
sunlight isn't bright enough today. And the night.
Thank you very much.